In the coming week, the G20 holds a pivotal summit in Rome. Japanese citizens head to the polls for parliamentary elections, and the COP26 summit begins in Glasgow. It's October 28th, 2021, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Stuart Patrick, sitting in for Jim Lindsay.
Stuart is CFR's James H. Binger Senior Fellow in Global Governance, and he directs the International Institutions and Global Governance Program. Stuart, as always, it's great to have you with us.
It's great to be back. Thanks, Bob.
Well, we'll kick off by talking about a group that keeps you up at night sometimes, I think, Stuart, perhaps. And that is the Group of 20. The Group of 20 is set to hold a summit in Rome this weekend, and leaders from across the globe, well, not all of them, are set to come together. They're going to talk about everything from COVID to climate, and maybe a little bit of taxation as well. Tell us a little bit about this summit and what we need to know about the G20 going into the weekend, Stuart.
Well, there's definitely not going to be any time for fiddling in Rome, as they say, or perhaps a lot of dining out in Rome's restaurants. The leaders basically have three huge things on their plate. They got a rampaging global pandemic, they've got a deepening climate crisis, and they've got a faltering world economy. So in principle, this should be the G20's moment to shine. It was created in crisis, first the Asian financial crisis, and then the global financial crisis. Of course, it was elevated to the leaders level. But so the big question is, can it rise to the occasion? And to do so, the leaders are going to have to do three things. They got to make credible commitments to expand vaccine access. They're going to have to hasten decarbonization, because this, of course, is taking place right before the Glasgow COP26, the big climate summit. And they've got to alleviate the crushing debt burden that a lot of developing nations are encountering. You know, you mentioned a lot of the world's going to be there, but a bunch of leaders aren't. Xi Jinping is not going to be there. He hasn't really traveled since the beginning of the pandemic. Vladimir Putin is a no-show. AMLO, the president of Mexico, not going. And the new Japanese prime minister, Kishida, is also not going to be there. So, you know, if that's a sort of a measure of the vote of confidence and the status of the G20, things don't look good. So it's a summit that demands big action. But I think that what we're going to see is likely to be more incremental.
Stuart, do you see in this crisis-driven environment, and given the roster you just went through, or the sort of the lacking roster, is it a moment where U.S. President Joe Biden steps in and starts to sort of steer the agenda, or is able to provide a bit more of global leadership in this case?
Well, you know, President Biden is really hamstrung. And depending on, you know, how the Build Back Better bill does, and whether or not, you know, right now it looks like he might get half a loaf in terms of what he's looking for, not $3.5 trillion, but more along the lines of 1.7, perhaps a little bit higher than that, if it goes through both houses on the Build Back Better bill. And, you know, in addition to the $1 trillion infrastructure bill. So that's still a big chunk of change that's going to give him some credibility.
And we should note that while we're taping this podcast, this is being sorted out potentially in Washington before Biden leaves, I think, later today.
That's correct. You're right. So there's a big question as to whether or not he can deliver. I think his interlocutors abroad are aware that, you know, the United States is highly divided politically. The razor thin margin in both houses of Congress, and, you know, a lot of divisions within his own constituency. So there's questions about that. I think more broadly, you know, the president, of course, speaks the language of global leadership, which is not a phrase we heard a lot from President Donald Trump. But there are big questions, right? I think there are questions amongst even some close allies about whether or not, you know, an American foreign policy for the middle class is just America first in nicer wrapping. I think there's also, you know, some criticism and some unease, even amongst close U.S. allies, that we're experiencing a little bit of a honeymoon period in sort of late spring and early summer about a lot of uncoordinated action that the president has taken, not least in Afghanistan, of course. And then there's really the sense that domestically, the low public approval ratings and the prospects of the Democrats losing the midterms, much less possibly having Donald Trump or one of his minions reappear or be elected in 2024, is really depressing confidence in global leadership on the part of the United States. That said, there are a number of things that can still be done that are very important to happen in Rome and in advance of Glasgow.
So you mentioned, you know, so many sort of front burner issues. Let's look at COVID for a second. The G7, this group of supposedly like-minded, you know, leading industrial democracies, had made a big point about trying to galvanize efforts in getting the vaccines out there. The vaccine efforts still seem to be trickling a bit, but is there anything we can take from any lessons from the vaccine effort that, first of all, can be used to accelerate the vaccination globally, as well as using for some of these other global crises?
Yeah, I mean, the pandemic is the leading threat to sustainable economic recovery right now. I mean, it is what is, and the lack of equitable vaccine access is really what is the biggest threat to, at least the biggest short-term threat to global economic progress. I mean, it's kind of ironic, you know, when the G20 was created, of course, it was really a collection of finance ministers and central bank governors. And for the most part, it's focused on macroeconomic issues, but increasingly it's focusing on other things. It's focusing on global health in addressing the pandemic. It's also focusing on the climate change. And it's visible in what the Italians, the way they framed this summit and indeed their whole annual presidency of the G20 is people, planet, and prosperity. What they're basically suggesting is, you know, you can't actually anymore separate the health of the global economy from the health of people and the health of the planet. So on the vaccines, you know, what needs to happen is the G20 really needs to join the G7 in helping the world turn the corner on COVID-19. Right now, there's only 4% of people in poor countries that have received one vaccine dose compared to over 60% in wealthy nations. So, you know, this vaccine inequity is playing havoc with supply chains and it's delaying recovery. So the G20 really needs to endorse a goal that's been set by the major multilateral institutions, including the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the World Trade Organization, the WHO. And that's to try to vaccinate, bring that 4% up to 40% in the next couple of months. That's a huge lift. And then get to 60% in the world by mid-2022. Again, those are very ambitious targets, but getting even close to them will make a big difference. With respect to climate, obviously, we can talk later about this summit that's going to be immediately after in Glasgow. But, you know, these are countries that are responsible for 80% or nearly 80% of greenhouse gas emissions. And the countries are way off target. Some countries have even come up with targets that are actually less ambitious. It's hard to get agreement with this group of countries because what you have are, in addition to the classic problems that countries want a free ride on the efforts of others, there's a difference within this grouping between developed countries that are responsible for the big stock of greenhouse gas emissions that are already in the air, and then developing countries, which are quickly rising to the top of current emissions. And there's debate over who's responsible and what their burden should be. The other thing is that there are major fossil fuel producers like Saudi Arabia, Russia, others, but then there's also major fossil fuel consumers, and they have different interests as well. So trying to get agreement on what new targets should be and you know, when folks should get to net zero is going to be a big deal. The last thing I would say is that the economic recovery is faltering. The IMF has pointed to what they call a dangerous divergence in the global economy. You know, as you recall, at the end of the global financial crisis, what you had was the countries that lagged in terms of their recovery were advanced market democracies like the United States, countries of the European Union. What's interesting in this case is that advanced economies, partly because they've done better in vaccinating their folks, are actually doing quite well, or at least much better coming out of the pandemic. What you see are a lot of emerging market economies and poorer countries that are really hurting, and they already have really overextended themselves, and they've taken on tremendous debt burdens, and those debt burdens are going to get bigger because there's a lot of inflation fear out there, and the major central banks around the world are likely to start tightening monetary policy. So you have this real possibility of a major debt crisis. So there's going to have to be some debt relief and more concessional lending that's given to those countries, but that's a big deal. The one thing that the G20 can do in this regard is to extend one of the best things that it did, which was a debt service suspension initiative. That's due to expire, you know, on December 31st of this year. And Antonio Guterres, the UN Secretary General, has been imploring the G20 countries to extend the deadline of that and then also expand its eligibility to middle-income countries. If the G20 did that, that would be a big move to help sustain global economic growth.
So, Stuart, could you help explain a little bit about the function of the G20? Because I think there might be some lack of understanding about how it really works. There's no sort of standing secretariat of the G20. This is a group that's, as you say, has been meeting for, you know, maybe a couple, 15, 20 years or so. They've started to galvanize over major issues, have become sort of a global firefighter of sorts, but they're not the IMF. They're not the World Bank, but they can do things like, as you said, you know, join forces together in terms of debt initiatives or their pronouncement about keeping trade free during the 2009 crisis. So could you say a little bit about, we have a G20 meeting this weekend, and then what do we take away in terms of what it can do?
Yeah, I think it's important to temper our expectations about the G20. I mean, this is not a treaty-based multilateral organization, right, that can take binding decisions or much less implement them, right? I mean, it's a consultative forum, you know, of the main advanced and emerging economies. And their leaders can, but only if inclined to do so, they can agree to coordinate national efforts. So the ultimate test of the G20's value is whether it can catalyze collective action, but not within the G20 itself, but within the formal institutions that exist exist that and that are capable of providing what are thought of as global public goods. It could be, you know, emergency lending to countries in distress, etc. So you could call this a sort of a, an informal negotiation forum in which the main countries that hold the vast majority of weight in institutions like the United Nations Security Council or the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund or the WTO can actually agree amongst themselves and then instruct their relevant ministers to take those positions within big organizations. It's meant to be a flexible entity that can rise to the occasion during crisis. The difficulty with the G20 is that initially when it was created, and it did pretty well during the global financial crisis, people thought, hey, let's have this be a permanent steering committee for all manner of issues in globalization. The problem is that when things were pretty calm, it didn't really function very well as a steering committee because national interests started reasserting themselves. But you always figured that if another crisis came along, or in this case, a constellation of crises, it could rise to the occasion. What you've seen instead, and partly as a result of U.S.-China frictions, is that it's often been hamstrung from addressing some of the bigger problems that are going on. Geopolitics has made it really hard to address some of these big global and transnational issues.
All right. Well, we will keep an eye on Rome then, Stuart, as we kick off an incredible weekend.
But Bob, let's turn our attention to an important parliamentary election that's going to be happening in the coming week in Japan. You recently spoke to Sheila Smith, who, of course, is CFR's Senior Fellow for Asia-Pacific Studies and expert on all things Japan, about the recent leadership elections in that country, which produced the country's new prime minister, Fumio Kishida, who's a member of the Liberal Democratic Party. Give us some context going into these parliamentary elections. What's at stake?
Well, Stuart, it's going to be very interesting because Japan is a country we haven't talked about that much in relation to the upheaval in major democracies. It's been under Shinzo Abe for years, incredibly stable by comparison, as a matter of fact. And part of that is because of the heft of the LDP, for decades the leading party in power in Japan. But Kishida has already indicated that he is expecting the LDP to emerge from these elections with not a supermajority, which it currently holds in the lower house, but a simple majority. And that means losing up to 70 seats, which is huge. It's tough for people who watch Japan, as Sheila Smith has, as you mentioned. You know, she mentions this is a big moment. So does the loss of 70 seats allow Kishida to actually govern? She says this such a loss would potentially hamper the success of any sort of policy agenda. And part of that is, you know, like other countries, Japan is still trying to navigate its way out of the COVID pandemic. It's now got vaccinations up. It's actually surpassed the U.S. at about 66% of the country getting at least its first shot of the two-shot variant. But, you know, it has still had its occasional spikes. And the Olympics that Japan hosted over the summer were overshadowed by, you know, the specter of, you know, surging cases and huge precautions taken that really kind of muted what it normally is a major, you know, sort of global event that really shines a positive light on a country. So it's COVID steps first.
How did COVID and the sort of Olympics, which, you know, as we saw, had generated a huge amount of controversy amongst the Japanese public. I mean, obviously they were delayed, postponed for a year, but even so seemed to generate a huge amount of controversy as to, you know, whether or not this was either responsible or a waste of money or a number of other complaints. How did the combination of those two things influence public opinion in Japan, including from previous Prime Minister Suga?
Yeah, I mean, it seemed like it added to the negative appraisal of LDP leadership and Prime Minister Suga's leadership. He had sort of, you know, announced, sort of surprised a number of people that he was going to be stepping down after, you know, barely a year in stewardship. And it was partly because public opinion leading up to the Olympics was that, you know what, this is probably not a good idea. There's too much risk involved here. They forged ahead and were seen as, you know, while they did pull off the Olympics, they did take place and a number of people remember the sporting triumphs and there were some incredible sporting achievements. But for the Japanese, I think it left a sour taste, the whole process, how the country went about it, that they were insistent on doing it. You know, it was a year late as it was. And so I think there has been a funk about how the country's stewardship of COVID, there was a bit of a slow rollout of vaccination, especially ahead of the Olympics, for example. But again, the country seems to have rallied a bit. And now it's sort of, how does it pull out of the economic tailspin that has hit so many countries? And how does Japan kind of get its mojo back? Kishida has stressed that he's going to provide funding for small and middle-sized businesses that have been really hammered by the pandemic, like they have, by the way, in a number of countries, including the U.S., that they were going to try to, you know, make sure there's a balance. Like other countries, Japan is concerned about inequality, the strength of massive corporations versus, you know, the household finances and so forth. So there's a sort of a priority among Kishida that there will be kind of a redistributive aspect to economic growth. And so that is one of the things that we're going to have to see. It's going to be a bit of a test at the polls. Will that be enough to maybe bring back some people who had soured on the LDP's leadership?
Bob, one of the things I I find really intriguing, and I'm no expert in Japan, is that the LDP has actually governed that country nearly continuously since 1955. I think there's only been about 4 years under different party control. And trying to figure out what accounts for its staying power and what that says about the nature of democracy in Japan is, you know, it's probably beyond my specific expertise, but it does suggest a confidence amongst the Japanese people in certain aspects of continuity and perhaps the LDP's ability to deliver, and perhaps a lack of willingness to take a chance on a number of other parties. There are quite a few parties, and they range quite widely in their political orientation, from Communist Party to folks that are extremely to the right. But there does seem to be a preference, even in this multi-party democracy, for sort of a predictable centrism on the part of the LDP. And perhaps even though Japan's had difficult times, including, you know, so-called lost decade a couple of decades ago in terms of growth, obviously faces huge demographic challenges, etc., there seems to be still a general sense of, if not being enamored, at least enough satisfaction with the LDP to make it the major choice for Japanese citizens. It'll be interesting to see whether or not this potential loss of seats on the LDP's part actually presages some more competitive and turbulent future for Japanese politics. But I do find it kind of fascinating.
No, and your reference to centrism, I think, is important, Stuart. As you mentioned, Sheila Smith is sort of our authority at CFR on all things Japan. She has a new piece in Foreign Affairs magazine about what's at stake, especially in foreign policy for Japan. But she mentions that in her writings that the LDP has had the ability to sort of contain, you know, rightist elements and more progressive elements, and has been able to be a bit flexible in that, and that this election will actually indicate also some generational changes. Well, is there a younger sense of the LDP's maybe changing role and how it sees Japan going forward? She did mention there seems to be more of a sense of continuity in terms of what the foreign policy challenges are, whether it's China and the relationship with China, whether it is bolstering Japan's military capability. This was a big area that Shinzo Abe moved the country in. And Kishida has indicated very clearly that he wants to bolster the military. And we should note he's a former foreign minister who's used to dealing with issues like diplomacy and arms control. But, you know, he basically has laid out the challenge that China poses to Japan. Japan's obviously concerned about ongoing missile testing by North Korea. And so you're going to see, I think, emerging from this election, a sense of Japan trying to beef up its military, at the very least, adding to the military spending as a proportion of GDP.
So it sounds like, from an American perspective, a certain amount of continuity with respect to the major regional challenges, including China and its ambitions, North Korea, and then perhaps the relationship with South Korea as well, which is always a tricky one for the Japanese.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I should also add that Kishida also continues to embrace the Quad, which is this combination of countries partnering in common purpose, India, Japan, Australia, and the United States. So that has strong Japanese support. Stuart, I want to talk about more summitry coming up, though. And this is the truly big one. It's actually a 12-day affair. And this is COP26. This is the United Nations Climate Change Conference of Parties that's going to be kicking off on Halloween Day, October 31st, in Glasgow, Scotland. There's going to be something like 20,000 or so heads of state, diplomats, all sorts of non-governmental activists and civil society representatives at the Conference of Parties. Can you give us a sense, Stuart? You've been following this issue closely. What's on the agenda? What should we be focusing on in Glasgow?
Well, I think, you know, what's on the agenda is, I guess, simply put, the future of the planet. Last month, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, its working group on the state of climate science, released its latest assessment, and it was dismal. The long-awaited climate emergency has arrived. The last decade, obviously, has seen some of the hottest years on record, or since records have been kept. Levels of atmospheric carbon dioxide are the highest in 3 million years. Oceans are more acidic than they have been in 2 million years. And based on the current trajectory of emissions, we are on track to reach 2.7 to 3 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. That is above pre-industrial levels. And that's, at the higher end, twice the level that is the target from the Paris Agreement. So the consequences of this would be devastating. So we've already begun to see many of those, from massive wildfires and the punishing droughts, water insecurity, and just real prospects of much worse to come. You know, sea level rise, for instance, that could contribute to hundreds of millions of climate migrants. So we need deep decarbonization and shifting from fossil fuels to zero carbon sources. But as I said, we're really, really off track. According to the emissions gap report that was released by the UN Environment Program just this week, it says that the world must reduce emissions 7 times faster than current commitments show to be able to reach the Paris Agreement. And, you know, coal, oil, gas, and gas production need to be declined by 50% over the next 9 years. So to say the least, these are hugely ambitious things. And there's a lot of reasons for these shortfalls. But basically, Glasgow is intended to help the world turn the corner on this. And as you mentioned, the leaders themselves will be meeting on November 1st and 2nd. And there are several major things they need to do.
Let's go back to President Biden. You mentioned his role in Rome. He's kicking off his trip actually with a visit to the Vatican. He's going to meet the Pope, with whom he has a lot in common as it relates to concerns about the environment.
That will be an interesting meeting because, of course, the Pope has been slightly more supportive of the president than some of the religious leaders in the United States.
So if he comes out of that meeting with some sense of common cause with the leader of the Catholic Church and takes that potentially a bit of a boost from G20, he could come into Glasgow with a sense of some marching orders, maybe some sense of helping to guide the process as they kick things off.
What will give him a real boost again, and as we're speaking, we're waiting to find out how the Build Back Better bill is going. Even if the president only gets half a loaf with respect to what he's got working its way through Congress, you know, he's still going to have some major legislative heft behind some of his promises to help the U.S. meet its targets. And they're quite ambitious. They include reducing U.S. greenhouse gas emissions by 50 to 52% from 2005 levels by the end of this decade, as well as achieving carbon neutrality in terms of the U.S. economy by 2030. There are a lot of very important things also in the infrastructure bill that would help get the country on a greener path. And the president has also suggested that there's a lot of things he could do at the executive level in terms of executive orders, in terms of fuel efficiency standards for cars, and many other things. One of the big losses, it appears to be, is in terms of electric power generation, a major element that a lot of environmentalists and scientists believe would have the biggest impact on reducing carbon emissions, appears to have been deleted from the bill at the behest of Senator Joe Manchin, who obviously the president has been trying to woo, along with Kristen Sinema of Arizona, to try to get to the required 50 votes in the U.S. Senate.
So there are other democracies at the meeting that represent conservative governments, including the host, Boris Johnson, Australia's Prime Minister Morrison. They've come out with pledges on limiting emissions and sort of stronger statements than you'd expect from conservatives in the United States. Do we see them also playing any sort of a role, a galvanizing role, given that you also have so much going on in the world in terms of populism and nationalism? Do they have a role to maybe sort of help focus efforts on the problem at hand?
There's no question that Boris Johnson's government has come up with a plan of significant ambition, a quicker reduction than in the United States and more ambitious targets. The Morrison government had been under a lot of criticism in Australia and abroad for really delaying ambitions. The Prime Minister recently released a stronger plan. It still, unfortunately, keeps Australia quite wedded to the export of coal. It is the world's leading exporter of coal. And obviously, that's deeply distressing because, of course, moving off of coal is one of the biggest things that the countries need to do. The other countries' pledges have been either weak or have not yet appeared. My understanding is that the Indians have yet to submit their nationally determined contributions, these NDCs, which under the Paris Agreement are supposed to be presented, these updated NDCs. The Chinese have really been resisting pressure to accelerate their transition, their planned transition to net zero from 2060 to 2040, and also to get off coal earlier. Now, China has made significant progress with respect to, it's the largest producer of solar panels. It's moving into renewables in a big way, but it still relies on coal, and its coal usage will not peak domestically until 2025 at the earliest. It has, on the brighter side, it's stopped funding coal-fired power plants in its Belt and Road Initiative around the world. So there are some decent signs, but there are also some really worrisome ones. With respect to Russia, not only has its plan not really been credible or ambitious, but there also were recent revelations that the Russians have been massively undercounting leaks of methane from a lot of their factories. On the more positive side of the methane front, there is a big methane effort and pledge that the United States and the European Union have been spearheaded, and a lot of other countries are signing up to that in anticipation of Glasgow. And that is extremely important because methane, although it's a smaller percentage of greenhouse gases, it has a greenhouse gas effect in terms of its contribution to global warming that is many times higher than carbon dioxide. So that's a relatively easy way to help fight global warming. And the US-UK plan would entail a reduction, a pledge of reducing methane emissions by the countries involved by 30% by 2030. So 30% by 2030. And that would be a big deal. But but there's much more that needs to happen.
And just on the methane front, I'd like to point our listeners to a piece our colleague Alice Hill co-authored that looks at the impact of intense heat and how it's been unfortunately building in recent years, and what are the policy challenges facing for that. I guess a final question would be, Stuart, coming back to China, which has been seen as the crucial country in many ways, and you mentioned what it has done, but also what it hasn't. And there have been reports that there are Chinese companies that alone account for more emissions than many countries in the world because of their reliance on coal and fossil fuels. Do you see in any sense of the U.S.-China dynamic and John Kerry's attempts to galvanize diplomacy with China, any sort of parallel to what we saw before Paris, where you ended up having the U.S. and China get together and announce an important agreement that ended up galvanizing, I think, the Paris talks?
You know, ideally, what you would see with respect to the United States and China is an agreement to, in a sense, compartmentalize and bracket off the more difficult aspects of their relationship so they can cooperate on an existential threat confronting all of humanity, namely climate change. And this is something that John Kerry has been, who's the president's special envoy for climate change, has been pushing hugely and wants to set up even a bilateral summit between Presidents Biden and Xi. Unfortunately, what you've seen within the White House is a real division here and some fissures between Kerry and his team on the one hand, and then the China hawks that want to take a very tough line and continue to do so, because Kerry's position would imply perhaps a little bit more give with respect to some of the more hot button issues and perhaps downgrading some of those hot button issues with respect to China. The reality is that even the Chinese have been skeptical of Kerry's desire to do this, because as the Chinese foreign minister said, you know, you're trying to carve out an oasis of cooperation, but surrounding that oasis of cooperation is a big desert. And by that, he means things like President Biden calling the struggle between autocracies and democracies the biggest and defining struggle of our age. And obviously, a lot of pushback with respect to Chinese ambitions in the South China Sea, a lot of criticism of its treatment, frankly, genocide of the Uyghur community, and other really shameful things that the Chinese government is doing. So again, a really tough dilemma here for the United States. How do you, in a sense, hold countries that are doing bad things around the world to account? How do you balance their power and at the same time try to cooperate with them on an issue of common agenda?
So, Stuart, give me three quick things we need to see from the Glasgow conference.
You know, so what needs to happen in Glasgow? I mean, first, there needs to be a lot more ambitious emissions reductions announcements to keep the goal of 1.5 degrees Celsius alive. I want to emphasize there is a world of difference between 1.5 degrees and 2 degrees in terms of impact. Every increment matters. And, you know, a lot of the problems with the nationally determined contributions right now is that many of them are just really squishy, right? They're not really verifiable, and there needs to be a way to verify them. In addition, there's no sort of global carbon pricing mechanism. And also some of the carbon prices that are put on, that countries have put on carbon emissions are way too low. So it's really important if we're going to try to get these emissions down seven times as fast as they need to hit the 1.5 degree target to have a much larger scale of ambition. Countries also need to get climate financing to the developing world. In Paris, there was a promise to mobilize $100 billion for developing countries, particularly to help them meet their adaptation needs. And the world is only about 80% of the way there, wealthy countries are, that is. The United Nations Development Program estimates that adaptation needs in developing countries could skyrocket by the end of the decade. Right now, they're about $16.7 billion a year. They could reach $300 billion a year over the next decade, which is just extraordinary. And there needs to be some way of wealthy countries helping developing countries finance these transition. You know, and then finally, Glasgow needs to find better rules to make these nationally determined contributions more credible. There need to be common standards for carbon markets to avoid double counting and emissions trading, for instance. There need to be common timeframes about what countries are promising. And there needs to be a lot more transparency and free flow of information to be able to hold countries accountable for the actions that they're actually pledging to take.
Okay, so we'll be keeping an eye on those things as this pans out, Stuart.
Well, Bob, I think it's time to pivot and discuss our audience figure of the week, which listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. This week, Bob, our audience selected 1 million euro fine, Poland versus EU. Why did our audience select this figure?
Well, Stuart, our audience is referring to the Court of Justice of the European Union ordering Poland to pay this fine of what amounts to about $1.2 million per day for failing to comply with an order back in July to suspend a disciplinary mechanism for judges. This mechanism has been found to basically been a way for the government in Poland to heavily infringe on judicial independence, which is sort of fundamentally at variance with the European Union norms as well as its legal order. So basically, the critics are saying Poland's disciplinary chamber that's been set up allows for judges to be dismissed on political grounds. There has been assurances from Poland's prime minister that they would be abolishing this disciplinary chamber, but there was no date announced. And there's a sense that it might be from some in the EU that it's being kicked down the road. The EU does not want a crisis erupting over its very nature of the EU integrity. But by the same token, there's a feeling that they have to sort of lay out some boundaries about what can be allowed and what should be punished.
There seems to be a lot of EU friction, or has been a lot of EU friction with the governing, I guess, the Law and Justice Party in Poland, and the erosion of the rule of law and the creeping authoritarianism that's been occurring. Couple of questions, I guess. I mean, can we see a Polexit, I guess, in which Poland actually decides to leave the European Union? Are we looking at a protracted standoff here? Or, you know, is basically Poland isolated within the EU, doesn't really have any allies, and it's just going to have to back down?
You're getting at what's the critical aspect here. Are we at a moment where the EU starts to, you know, divide against itself and such that, you know, countries pull away and you have these various exits, the various prefixes taking place? Opinion polls have shown that more than 80% of Poles want to remain in the EU. I think the EU remains similarly popular in Hungary, another illiberal democracy in the EU that has faced threats from EU bodies in the past. And so we'll see whether the temperature is gets raised such that the government feels like it has no other choice but to try to, you know, maneuver or some sort of Polexit, or at least threaten it and maybe challenge the EU in its you know, in its fines and so forth. So I think it's a real gut check moment for both Poland and for the EU, Stuart.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You know, there's some material aspects of this too, just in the sense of material benefits. You know, there may be some sympathy with the EU and the symbolism of Poland being a member of the EU. Obviously, a lot of memories of being a part of another bloc that was perhaps less conducive to freedom. So that may be playing a role, but it's also interesting that from the perspective of Poland's ruling party, Poland is a net beneficiary, of course, of many of the structural funds.
That's right. It's believed to be the biggest net recipient of EU funds. So there's a lot at stake there. Hungary, by the way, also benefits quite well from the EU, which is, again, why this relationship seems to continue and why there's a bit of brinksmanship going on both sides. But this is, again, this gets down to the fundamental rule of law, really, principles of the EU. And so it's going to be really important to see how this plays out.
Yeah, absolutely. EU obviously wants to avoid another referendum or other decision that's taken on the basis of sort of perceived slights to sovereignty. But on the other hand, it has to, or has a strong interest in keeping certain norms and standards and not allowing the weakening of some of those principles. So yeah, it'll be a fascinating thing to watch in the weeks and months ahead. Well, Bob, that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. South Korean President Moon Jae-in embarks on a 9-day trip to Europe. A constitutional referendum takes place in Mali, and Diwali is celebrated in India.
Well, please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please leave a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. By the way, the articles mentioned in this episode are listed on the podcast page for TWNW on CFR.org. Please note that opinions expressed on The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Shirley. Zoe also doubled as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks to Maya Kin, Terrence Mullen, and Anya Zeliniak for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons.
This is Stuart Patrick saying goodbye.
Stuart, thanks as always. And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay healthy out there.